My name is Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome back. Polly made some great points from her experience. This lack of power is our dilemma, is something that is often confused by people. I have known over the years and I've sponsored some members of clergy. I've known some, I knew a Catholic priest who I was fairly close to. He drank himself to death. And we're not talking about, you know, a lot of Catholic priests have been in the news over the last few years. We're not talking about that kind of deal. This is a good guy. This is a guy who all he wanted to do was serve God. And I remember when about a week before they found him dead, he called me up and he was weeping into the phone. And he's weeping into the phone because he's back drinking again, and he'd been begging God not to let him ever drink again. And he doesn't understand why a man of the cloth who's devoted his whole life to serving God, and he's drinking, he can't stop drinking, keeps going back to it. And there, and in AA, there's robbers and pimps and hookers and stuff staying sober forever. Right? He just doesn't think this is fair at all. But lack of religion's not our problem. It's not even lack of faith. It's lack of power. I've noticed something all my life that was perplexing to me, and it used to just bug me, is that growing up, there were guys in school, later years, there were people in my neighborhood and people at work, people out there in the world who, for some reason, everything they touched turned to gold, and they were just happy all the time. They were just lit up all the time. They just enjoyed life. They were grateful for everything in their life. And then there's me. Right? And I don't know why everything I touch turns to crap and everything they touch turns to gold. Because I'm smarter than them. And after I got sober, I had a company for a number of years, and I had a lot of employees, and I had employees that were like that. That were just happy guys. They weren't in conflict with nothing. And they just naturally seemed to go with the flow of power in the universe. Some of these people are religious people. Some aren't. Some just intuitively know the benefit of helping others and thinking about others and going with the flow. And something lit them up. Whether they were cognizant of it or not. I live in the desert, and I live in an area where in July and August, it at times will get to be 120 degrees. Now, people in Vegas will tell you, "Oh, it's okay, it's a dry heat." Yes, so's hell. when it's 120 degrees, it's hot, man. I'm telling you. And if I were to take you in my car when it's like 120 degrees south of town, I could take you down to Lake Mead. And Lake Mead is one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the United States. And take you right up to the lake, let you drink from the lake. And then take you back in my car, drive you about 20 miles away out in the middle of the desert, and drop you off in the middle of the desert with a map showing you where I'm dropping you off. Showing you on the map where Lake Mead is. You can have absolute faith that the Lake Mead's there and that water's there. But if you wander around that desert and don't follow the directions on that map, you will die of thirst knowing that the water's there. And Frank died of alcoholism knowing absolutely that the power was there. But he couldn't access the power. He had too much of himself between him and God. And he had too many old ideas that really you'd think would help, but they didn't. Page 46, in the middle of the page, it talks about two things that are necessary to begin to access the power. And it doesn't even say I have to believe. It says, yes, we have agnostic temperament, have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to, this is the first thing, to lay aside prejudice. Well, what's that mean? Well, prejudice comes from a couple Latin words that have been put together. It really means prejudgments, preconceived notions, opinions. And the problem I've discovered with prejudice is that I can have a lot of prejudice and never know their prejudice. Well, those aren't prejudices. That's just the way it is. I don't even get it. I don't even get that they're prejudiced. It's just the way it is. And the book's asking me to lay them aside. And I with the guys I sponsor, often if I have a sense that they have a lot of those, I will spend some time with them. What are your notions? What are your judgments? What are your opinions? What is your sense of God and life and the spiritual, the spirit here? When people, when the idea of turning your will and your life over to the care of God pops up, what's that do to you? How do you feel about that? And what I discovered is that a lot of us have prejudices about God we don't even know. We're not even aware of it. Some things we picked up as childhood. And one of them that is so common, I won't go so far as to say it's universal among alcoholics, but I've encountered it so frequently that it may very well be. And that is the unconscious deep sense that I am not good enough to merit God's help. In the light of what I've done and the people I've hurt and the hearts I've broken and the lies I've told and the sleazy self-gratification things I've done. In the light of all of that, I can't possibly merit God's help. I always unconsciously always had this feeling that if there was 5 billion people on the planet, I don't know how many people there are, but if there was 5 billion people on the planet and God was going to help 4,499,499,499 and he's going to leave out a few, I know what group I'm in. You know, I'm in the group that's going to get the short end of the stick because I know how I feel about it. I know what I did. I know the guys that went to prison as a result of me. I know the families I'd ruined. I know what I did. I know what I did to my mother and father. I know what I did to the people that loved me. And that's a common thing, this prejudice. And Scott L. from Nashville and myself and his wife and a bunch of AAs, we were in Florence last August. And I went there. It's my second time to go to Florence. And I'm there. I went there. And the first time I went, I was searching for this statue that I'd heard about and I couldn't find. And I finally did my homework and I found out where it was. In fact, I got a picture of it if anybody wants to see it. And it's a statue by a sculptor by the name of Donatelli. And I'd heard of this statue and I really wanted to see it. So we found the museum. It was right behind the Domo, and it's called the Opera Museum. And I'm with a whole crowd of people, and I'm taking them to this museum. And we get in the door of the museum, and I'm like an ADD kid. I'm running around. I don't even know where they are anymore. I'm just looking for this statue, man. I'm just zooming through these rooms, you know, like a crazy guy because I'm obsessed with finding this statue. And I come into this room, and there's this huge crucifix hanging there, life-size. And I look, turn and look, and there it is, the statue of Magdalena. And it took my breath away. And this is not your typical depiction of Mary Magdalene. This is a woman that's scarred, a woman dressed in rags that are tattered, a woman that has a despair in her face and a hopelessness and a self-loathing, as if she'd been turning nickel and dime tricks on the back alleys of Jerusalem for years. And she stands there, and and she's looking up at something, and her head's cocked, and her hands are like this. They're not in prayer. She's too afraid to do that. She's too unworthy to even put her hands together and pray. And I looked at her, and I saw that her teeth had been kicked out, and they were broken and jagged. And she's looking up at this statue, and I look to see, and she's looking at the crucifix with an expression on her face as if she's saying, this could be for me? For me? And I'm standing there, and it's a public museum, and I'm weeping. And I'm weeping because that's me. That's me when I came to God. This could be for me? After all I've done? And I'm in there, I'm crying, and there's normal people are walking through, and then next thing I know, Scott Lee's there, and he weeps over everything. Oh my God! There's all these Italian people are going through, going, God, these Americans, just they're weird, man. I'm telling you. And if you weren't an alcoholic, I don't know if you'd get it. I don't know. Boy, I got it. If anybody wants to look at the picture, it's one of the most beautiful statues I've ever seen. The picture doesn't do it quite justice as the life size. And then the second thing, if I can lay aside these prejudices, these things that put me in a position where I'm too afraid to trust the light. And then the second thing, it says, and express even a willingness to believe. It doesn't even say I have to believe. But can I make an expression of a willingness? What a brilliant approach. See, they know how I am. They know I'm the guy you say, Bob, believe. Because I'm a people pleaser. I say, oh, yeah, I believe. Where's my gun? I can't, but I can do this. And this is an action program. That's why there's no chapter in the book. Is a chapter called Into Action. There's no chapter in here into thinking or into believing or into feeling. And they're asking me to take some action, to express a willingness to believe. And I guess the best way to do that is to do a physical demonstration. And the old timers in AA had me physically, they told me I had to physically get down on my knees every morning and every night and pray. And I didn't, I'll tell you, I go to meetings, I hear about people, they don't get on their knees, they pray in the car. They pray sitting on the crapper, for God's sakes. Why do I get, I told this guy, I said, how come I said, there's a lot of people in AA don't have to get on their knees. How come I do? And they said, you're right. He says, you're right. A lot of people don't. He said, just people with egos like yours. I go, oh, man. And I felt like a hypocrite. You know what? I'm living in this halfway house, right? So I go in the bathroom. I close and lock the door. I get the throw rug. I push it up against the crack under the door because nobody's going to see me pray. I'm telling you, right? And I get down on my knees, and I feel stupid. I feel like a hypocrite because I don't believe in God. I mean, I'm not fighting it like I used to. Not the militant atheist I imagined myself to be at one time, the intellectual guy. But I don't know and if there's a God or not. And this guy, and I go back to this guy, and I said to him, I said, you know, I don't think I should be praying. I don't really know if there's belief in God yet. I said, I feel like a hypocrite. And he says, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What the hell's the difference? And he was right. I'd been a hypocrite all my life. I was the guy that would tell you one thing. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. And then when it came time to do it, I don't feel like doing it. I don't do it. I do what I want to do. I'd never been of one mind. I was a flake. And he said, just do it. Let's see what happens. And what they're doing is they're immersing me in what could be considered a working hypothesis. Let's see. Let's see what happens if you act as if the power's there. Let's see if it shows up or not. Let's see. You know, if I were to, years ago, there was people that existed down in New Zealand, and Kate's from New Zealand, Australia, called Aborigines, and some of the, at one time, those people never had experienced modern conveniences and technology, electricity, none of that stuff. And if you would have grabbed, I remember reading this article when I first got sober in National Geographic about these guys. If you would have grabbed one of those guys and you brought him into this room when all the lights are out and you showed him the panel of switches and you told them that you push those buttons, this room's going to light up like daylight. You know, they're not going to believe you. If you gave them a lamp and you said, there's power in these walls. If you find a hole in the wall, you take those two prongs, you plug it in there, that lamp will light up. They're not going to believe there's power in those walls to do that. But it doesn't matter. If they plug the lamp in, it lights up whether they believe it or not. And all of a sudden they realize that what you were saying is right. There actually is power there. And I didn't believe the power was there, but I started acting as if. And what started happening to me is I started getting lucky. And I'm not a lucky guy. I don't have good luck. And I started having good luck. I got out of nowhere. I wasn't even looking, the perfect job came to me. It got me out of the halfway house, which was, I think I'd have died if I'd have stayed there because my one roommate was selling heroin and the other one was smoking pot. I was on thin ice. Got me out of there, gave me a room and board and a job working with teenagers in a treatment center where I could be helpful. I could be other centered, and it didn't pay me enough money. If it paid me a lot of money, I'd have gone to a saloon and tell everybody how smart I was. It paid me just enough money to start chipping away at some amends and put a dollar in the basket and have cigarettes, you know, just basic. It was divinely, it was perfect, divinely crafted for me. I started going to meetings, and I would hear people say exactly what I needed to hear that day. I'd have times where I'd be depressed and all messed up, and the phone would ring, and there'd be some guy in AA calling me. Who made him call me? Right at that moment. One morning, I'm at work, and I am just enraged. My boss and I had had a little conversation. And I don't take criticism well. I really don't. And I am just enraged. I want to punch him and quit my job. And I'm just like, nuts, man. And he's disrespected me, man. And I'm telling you, I'm hot. And instead of going and getting a sandwich like I usually do, I rushed across town to a noon meeting that I normally wouldn't go to. And I'm in a meeting I normally wouldn't go to. And I don't know. I know a couple people there, but not that many of them. And there's a guy in there I don't even know who starts talking about this experience he had at work where he got criticized for not doing his job the way he was supposed to and how he made him insane. And how he talked to his sponsor, and he was going to quit his job, and his sponsor told him he had to go make amends to his boss. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, oh my God, that's exactly what's going on. I don't have to quit my job. I got to go make amends to my boss. And I went back there that afternoon. I made amends to my boss. I told him, I said, you're right. I'm sorry. I was out of line. I don't do criticism well, but you were right. And he lit up, and I got to stay there for a while. I didn't have to quit. Who made that guy say that day? Who put the idea in me? What put the idea in me that I should go to that meeting, that particular meeting? There was about three lunch meetings at the time. Why that day? Who's the choreographer? Who's behind the curtain pulling the levers on this stuff? And I started to come, I guess, to believe that there was something working in my life. From the minute I started acting as if, it started to happen. And a lot of it I was asleep to. You know, because you know how the kind of egos we have. We have the kind of egos. Got you into a great miracle in my life, and you go, oh, yeah, I did that. Right. You know. It's not that I'm against the idea of God. I just don't like the competition. You know, right. So it took a lot of those coincidences for me to start to believe. I was over in London last summer. I'm going over a couple times this year too, but do a men's retreat over there and a big book conference over in Scotland. And there's a section of London where the streets have gas street lights rather than electric, which we're used to. And today, with today's technology, they're all on electric starters that they're computerized that turn them on like the gas automatically, et cetera, every day. But there was a time years ago before that technology was in place when there was a guy whose job it was to go up and down the streets of London that had the gas streetlights, and he had a key. And he'd put his key into the post, and he'd turn the gas on. And then he'd reach up with a long pole with a flame on the end, and he'd light the street light. And you could climb up at twilight to the top of the highest building in London and look out over the city. No matter how hard you looked, you couldn't see where this guy was. But you could always see where he'd been by the lights. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 2 years sober, and I honestly, I couldn't see where God was, not at that moment. I often today, it's hard for me. I get too much of me on me to really see God's presence in my life. And I couldn't see where God was at that point. But I'll tell you, I could see where he'd been. I could see because of the things that were happening in my life. And I've been very, you want to see God work? Do 12-step work. Start going into the detoxes, the places where people are dying. And I got to really see the hand of God working in some of the newer people that came after me. It's hard sometimes to see God work in your own life. And the reason is he works slow, but he's old. Give him a break, man. He's old. And trying to watch God work in your life is almost like trying to stand in front of a mirror and watch your hair grow. It doesn't mean it's not growing. It's just a slow thing. You just But I could see it in the new guys. The guys, I saw guys who had their kids taken away and had restraining orders, will never see their kids again. 2 years sober, I had one of my sponsees. His three kids were hiding in the next room to bring him his cake out. Oh, man, what a meeting. And they looked at him. They looked at him like, that's my dad. I've watched homeless guys that were living in the bushes by a house. Whew. I've watched guys that have been in and out of psychiatric wards and on medications for years. Multiple suicide attempts. Free. They don't take nothing. They're sponsoring a bunch of guys. They're lit up. Their spirit is alive and they're free. You don't see that anywhere else except in that venue. Just going to a meeting to check in with your buddies, you don't see that, but you'll see it in the trenches a lot. You'll see God work. And I try to stay in those trenches. Page 55. Two of my favorite paragraphs in the book. These two paragraphs in the middle of the page, it says a couple things that are very bold and yet very right. I was at an AA retreat, oh God, I don't know, it must have been 27 years ago, I suppose. And there was a Catholic priest who was leading the retreat who was also sober a lot of years. And this is a man, and he gave a little bit of his story, and he had taught theology at the Vatican. I mean, this is like top of the food chain for knowing about God. And he just, not just Catholic theology, he was versed in everything, Buddhism, Hindu, everything. This guy knew it. And he said something that got my attention. He said, I never knew how to connect with God until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew everything about him, but I couldn't connect. And he talked about these two paragraphs on page 55. When he first read them, he was offended that a washed-up proctologist and a burnout stockbroker would tell a man of his education in theology how to find God. And yet, as he worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, he found out that what they said on page 55 was exactly right. It became his experience just as it was Bill's. It says in the second full paragraph, it says, actually, we're fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down in you. Mm-hmm. I used to hear old-timers say that. And I don't know what they're talking about. I used to hear people say, well, I pray and then I get still, and in meditation I listen for God, for intuitive. I don't know what they're talking about. I go inside me. I don't get God. I get a pack of crazy people chattering all the time. Right? That's why we don't. If you're brand new, we don't suggest. If you're going to try meditation, no sharp objects in the room. Because when it gets quiet out here, it gets noisy in here, man. But I hadn't done it. I hadn't done what's necessary to open the channel yet. It's deep down within me. I remember watching Chuck Chamberlain. He spoke at our end of the month meeting one time, and somebody came up to him after the meeting and asked him, how do you find God? And Chuck says, he's not lost. He's right in there, and he's pointing right in the guy's chest. He's right in there. Well, why can't I get a sense of that? Why, when I get quiet, I just get crazy? Next line is exactly what the truth is for me. It says that's because the power, this God within inside me, it's obscured from me. It's blocked from me. It's blocked by, obscured by three things. By calamity. I like calamity. I'm a calamity guy. You know what I'm saying? I don't like going over the edge, but I like the view from it. You know what I mean? I like getting right out there. I like that adrenaline, you know. Before I ever found drugs and alcohol, my first drug of choice was adrenaline. I'd steal stuff out of stores and run down the street as they're yelling at me. Oh, man, you get away? Oh, nothing better than that. Right? I like calamity. If I go to a roller coaster, if I go to an amusement park and there's one of those wish you're going to die, jump the track roller coasters that'll make you sick to your stomach and a merry-go-round, I don't even notice the merry-go-round. I see that roller coaster. Oh, my God, look at that. Oh. If you want to hear what the voice of calamity would sound like, imagine that a surgeon could surgically implant a microphone into your brain. We'd hook it up to these loudspeakers, and on a bad day, we'd hear everything you thought. We would hear calamity. We would hear legion. I mean, it was so no wonder I can't, when I try to get quiet and go inside myself, there's no sense of God. Because if God is inside me, he'd need, even if he had a megaphone, I'm not going to hear him over this crazy chatter in my head. The second thing that's blocking me from God is pomp. And pomp, I think, is a great word for ego, for self. Is that I get so full of myself and my opinions and my judgments and what I need that there's no room for anything else. I'm like a glass of water filled to the top. Ain't going to take nothing. It's full. My mother used to say that to me when I was a little kid. Before I ever drank, she used to say, and I never understood it till I was sober and started getting into the steps. She used to say, Rob, you're full of yourself. I didn't know what she was talking about. I was full of myself. Pomp. And the third thing says worship of other things. Well, that was a hard one to see. I worshiped a lot of stuff all my life, and I don't get it because I don't know what worship means. I don't know that I do that. You know, I'm thinking they mean, you know, to bow down and, you know, or something. I don't do that. But I worshiped a lot. And I was sober over a year, and I was ending about a year and a half. I was ending my first sober relationship. And I got to tell you, in my experience, and I work with a lot of guys that have relationship problems from time to time, I don't think there's a person on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. You can go up to a guy like that and say, I just came from the doctor. I have terminal cancer, three weeks to live. And he'll go, do you know what else she said? I mean, right, this is... That's exactly... I mean, it just gets on us right here. And we'll get into the reasons about that when we get into step four. But it gets on you, man. You can't... And so I go to this meeting because I'm nuts, man, and I'm trying to get some help, but I can't hear nothing in the meeting. Because the Big Show's on the inside, right? I'm up in my head in the meeting thinking about if I ran into her, well, I'll say this. And then she'd probably say that. And then I'll say this. And she'll say that. And then I'll say this. And she'll realize how wrong she'd been and beg for my forgiveness and want to come back. You know, so no matter, God could be trying to talk to me through the people in the meeting. It's not getting in, right? Nothing's getting in. I got too much of me between me and the people in A and too much of me between me and God. And she's a member of AA, and she's not in that particular meeting, which means that some hideous force has planted a spring in the back of my neck connected to the meeting room door. Every time the meeting room door opens, I go, oh, not her. So you can imagine I'm not getting a lot out of this meeting, right? The meeting's over. I end up going out to coffee with a guy from Glendale, California, who's visiting. He was sober 28 years. And I'm sitting in this coffee shop. He's riding in my car, and I'm going to take him back to his hotel. And I got him kind of hostage. And because I got him hostage, I start talking about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes till his eyes have glazed over. And he's sitting. He's a very kind man. He's sitting there, and he's listening to me. He's nodding his head. And when I run out of gas, and I'm just sitting there, he says to me some things that would blow my mind. He said to me, he says, kid, you ever thought about the first commandment? And I got a little bit on the muscle when he said, I said, no, I'm not really into that. I'm just an AA. And he starts laughing. He says, yeah, I know. He says, God, he says, you and I are a lot alike. He says, guys like us, we can't get past the thou shalt not. And he says, I believe that the Ten Commandments were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect, as they were translated out of through the Aramaic and Greek and Latin, et cetera, finally got to the English, they had an authoritarian spin put on them. He said, the first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not put false gods before me. He said, listen, he says, I know that I can do whatever I want and God will love me. He said, there's nothing you can do that get God to stop loving you. You can put anything you want between you and God will still love you. The problem is you've just put something between you and God. You've just blocked the light. When you worship something, he says it's not to bow down to, it's to simply obsessively turn your consciousness towards. He said, you want to know what you're worshiping? Make a pie graph of your day. And the thing of all the stuff you're thinking about, and the thing that owns the pie would obviously be the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards. When he said that, I could picture this pie graph with a little sliver for AA, a little sliver for work, and the rest of it was her. And it was like all of a sudden I knew why I was so desolate, and I knew why I was a prisoner in. I found out later of the bondage of self, but I felt like I was trapped in these emotions. And I wish I could tell you that, well, I came to my senses and never did that again. That's not the case. As a matter of fact, if there's someone here in the room that has gotten over that, don't do that anymore, would you sponsor me? because I do that frequently. It could be something, just simple little tiny things, like the way somebody's driving. Just get it stuck in my craw. I've grown spiritually to the point where I don't follow them past their exit anymore. Right. I had the white car, so it must have been 7 years ago. I was 7 years ago. I was sober over 20 years, for God's sakes. I had an allocation with a guy. Because the problem is, once you start living a spiritual way of life, if you regress back to that old ego-driven behavior, you hate yourself afterwards. You want to go out in the garden and eat worms. I mean, it was horrible. It's horrible. Sometimes it's been relationships. Sometimes it's been business. Sometimes it's been money. Sometimes it's been what I think I need to get you to see that I'm right about. But every time I grab a hold of something and put it between me and God, I block the light. No wonder my spirit starts to feel suffocated. There's a line in our literature that says that we need this stuff just as much as we need air. And the word spiritual in the Latin means breath of life. When I'm spiritually sick, it feels like somebody sucked the air out of the room. That's why alcohol was so amazing. I could be so depressed and locked inside of me, and after the first double shot of whiskey, everything in me would just go, like I could finally breathe. Like the air was back in the room again. Like I had a freedom. And these are the three things that obscured me, but the book goes on to say, in some form or other, it is there for faith in a power greater than ourselves, and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly. There's only one other place that I know of that uses those two words in the same sentence, and that's step four. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And if you've known anything about the Oxford group, Buckman had this experience that led him to believe and to create the tenets of the Oxford group. And in the tenets of the Oxford group, you couldn't turn your will in your life over to the care of God. You don't have a shot till you clean house first. And in AA, it's very similar, even though our step three is before four and five. But it's not until after the fifth step. And the fifth step promises that we're finally promised that the nearness of our, now we will experience the nearness of our Creator. Because what's happened? I've moved enough of me and my judgments and my crap out of the way that now I'm closer to God. It's at that point that it says, doesn't say after step three, I will begin to have a spiritual experience. It says after step five. So sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. And that's what the steps are designed to do. They're designed to move enough of me out of the way that I can claim my inheritance. I can immerse myself in a flow of power that if I keep the channel clean, it'll stay in my life. And I block the channel up occasionally. I just do it. But if I do that, then I'm the guy that things work click for. Remember, if some of you may have seen this, there was a basketball game years ago, very famous in basketball history now, where Michael Jordan was playing, and it was right at the buzzer, the end of the game. And they were behind by, I think, 1 point. And he made a half-court shot that swished, and it blew everybody's mind. And they won the game. Everybody stood up, were screaming and cheering. And Jordan's running down the court going. And he was interviewed later, and they asked him, how'd you do that? And he says, you know, I don't think I did it. He says, sometimes you're in the zone. And when you're in the zone, things just click. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to get me in God's grace, which is the zone. That's the zone where my life works. There's a part in the book that says this is the way to a faith that works. This is such pragmatic stuff. We're going to enter into a process this afternoon that's designed to vitalize my spirit and connect me with something. This deep down inside of me, it's almost as if deep down in me is a portal to the hard drive of the universe. That if I can open that portal, then I can start to go with the flow and get intuition. And even if you've never worked the steps, you've all had moments where God has peeked through self and you've had those senses of, oh, I shouldn't go with them. And if you went against it, later you realized what was God's trying to talk to you. Or maybe you didn't go with them and they ended up in prison. There's always something inside of us that we're blocked from. And I believe it is the essence of God. It is God's grace which is inside of me. And it says, in the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. That means after I look everywhere else. I was a couple years sober. This is before I'd worked the steps. In my first first 4 years of sobriety, I went through 9 jobs. And because I'm so self-centered and judgmental, and you know, and it was horrible. But there's an employer who's trying to save me. He thinks I'm redeemable. So he gives me a set of tapes, not AA tapes. These are motivational tapes by a guy named Earl Nightingale. They were called Lead the Field. And years ago, I guess they were big. They were kind of like, he was like the Anthony Robbins of his day, I suppose. And I'm listening to these tapes because I'm trying to do what this guy's telling me to do because I don't want to go through another job. And in this tapes, Earl's telling a story about this guy who was raised in South Africa, and he grew up and inherited a ranch from his father. And he tells the story that this ranch was a nice ranch. I mean, it could have made a nice living for him and his family for generations. But the problem was he inherited the ranch at the time at the beginning of the diamond boom in South Africa, and he was hearing the stories of these guys becoming overnight mega Bill Gates kind of rich. And the more he heard of their abundance, the more dissatisfied he became with what he had. I know that sounds familiar to some of you. And finally, he sells the ranch, and he takes the money from the sale of the ranch, and he goes out to the bush, obsessed with finding diamonds. And he never did. I read 2 accounts. One account said he actually committed suicide after years out there, never striking it rich, and threw himself in the ocean. Earl's account was that he just never did strike it rich, and he died out there bitter, broke, and alone. And it came to pass that he'd sold the ranch to these 2 brothers who were developers. And one day, they're clearing out some boulders and stuff, and they found these unusual rocks, crazy-looking rocks. They'd never seen anything like it. And they took it to a guy, and the guy says, man, those are uncut diamonds. They discovered that this ranch was the largest diamond deposit ever recorded in South Africa, right? Now, overnight, these 2 brothers are like 2 of the richest men in the world. And now they got to put this company together. They got to hire all these people to work to mine these diamonds. They got to hire people to cut them and polish them. And then they have to have a marketing network worldwide. And they're trying to put this together one day. And one brother says to the other, hey, we got to name our company something. The other brother says, yeah, let's name it after that poor SOB we bought the ranch from. Wasn't his name De Beers? And I'm listening to this story, and I'm thinking, I'm that knucklehead. I'm looking everywhere else for power. I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous probably twice a day and hear them read something, and I don't hear them read it. I'm sitting in the meeting, and they're reading, and these are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. Well, I need a new job. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need a Harley Davidson. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need more sponsees. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need to be delegate. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need to get laid. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery, period. And I'm the knucklehead. I'm looking for validation, security, and power everywhere else. And it's always been right here. And I to take the journey within. Polly?
Thanks, Bob. Gosh, I'm so engrossed there that I can't even. Anyway, I just kind of want to move in to step 3 journey into step 3. And step 3 is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And when I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not understand that step. Because I thought at that point in time, before I could take that step, in order to take that step, I somehow had to totally surrender myself to God, and I was supposed to feel something. See, I don't know about you, but I'm the feel-good person. I like chemicals that make me feel good. I like actions that make me feel good, and that's, I think, why I liked alcohol and drugs, why I like sex, why I like food, you know, all of this stuff. I like to feel good. And so if I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I must be going to feel something. But that's not what the step says. The step says that I made a decision. So what I'm going to do, and I like the analogy that was given to me when I first sobered up, and it's the one I still use today, is Frank looked at me and he says, Polly, it's like going to college. You make a decision to go to school, and then you spend the next 4 years doing it. And what I'm going to do in this step is I'm going to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And what I have to do in making that decision is I've got to take some actions in order to do that. So once I make this decision, I'm going to embark upon a program of action. And even so has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly, but he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When he drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. I believe that the minute I said, I'm willing to do this, was when I began, without even realizing it, that I began to sense that God had disclosed himself to me. Because now if I'm going to take this step, I'm going to embark upon a program of rigorous honesty. Now, up to now, you know, we've just been kind of been contemplating the steps. But now I'm going to have to take some action. And one of the things that Sylvia and I were talking about that this morning, about in step three, because one of the things that it says after the prayer, and I'm going to let Bob do that because since this is my first time working with him, I think that I want to see how you do that with everybody. But what it talks about is that we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person. That's on page 63. Such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. And one of the things that happened for me is that I was working with a man who had been a man of God. He had been a Monsignor priest. Now, I'm not Catholic, but I think that's pretty high up, isn't it? He had been a captain in the Navy, and he was an only child. And I was a military wife. I had been brought up in a very fundamental religion, and I'm an only child. And I had been given, and he, like me, had been given everything that a kid could want, but yet he had somehow, he was a priest, and he couldn't find God. And he once told me, he says, you know something, Polly? If you're a priest, you have power. People listen and do what you tell them to do. And he says, that power that I had over other people kept me away from God, obscured. That's what he was talking about, kept me away from God. And he was beginning to tell me that your feelings, these feelings of low self-esteem, inadequacy, all of these feelings, and I hope you all look at this picture because it's just beautiful. All of these character defects are keeping me from God. Because what happens is I don't believe that God is going to love and take care of somebody like me. Even though every teaching I've ever had growing up as a little girl, no matter how many fire and brimstone, you know, guys were going at it, I still, you know, telling me how much Jesus loves me and all that, all I could hear, because I'm an alcoholic, is that I'm going to burn in hell. And that's what I feel like. So, you know, I can't be 36 years old and just now be making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And I couldn't get the idea that I could formulate a vision of God and that God be mine. I thought it had to be somebody up in the sky, long beard, robes, you know, sitting on a throne. I don't know. I mean, this was the kind of envision I had. Yet, that's what I saw. But what they were teaching me is here was a God that was the kind of God that I needed, the kind of God that went out and looked up prostitutes, went out and found 12 disciples that were fishermen, stinky and dirty and all. I mean, this was the kind of God was looking for people just like me. The lost, that kind of God. But I couldn't see that. I had this other idea of God. And so here was a man of God trying to teach me what he had learned in AA, and it was nothing like what he had learned to become a priest. Nothing. He says, what I've learned is I come into the rooms of AA, and I find out I'm powerless. I don't have power over anybody. I'm powerless. And I'm going to come to believe in a power. My God, I've been believing in me. What stands in the way of me and God, and the reason I don't feel what I think I ought to feel, is me. I am so full of me. And one of the things that I'm the whiny kind of drunk, you know. Doesn't mean I'm any less arrogant. It just means that nobody loves me. Nobody likes me. You know, I'm so inadequate. I do everything wrong. I mean, all of that stuff that's just enough to get on your last nerve. And, you know, I am that kind of drunk. And as my AA sponsor says, so if you think that if you feel that way about yourself, that that's real humility and that, you know, it's all because you're such a good person. Let me tell you what my AA sponsor says. Dottie looks at me and she says, Polly, it's not necessary you think well of yourself. You just think only of yourself. Doesn't mean that I think good. It's just all I'm doing is thinking about me. And, you know, even if it's look what I've done to my kids and I can't suit up as a mother and I can't, you know, all of that stuff. And now I'm being asked to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this care of this to this God that I am sure wants. I really believe God was out to kill me. That's what He wanted to do. He just wanted to kill me because it kept saying that that when I was learning all this stuff in when I was going to Sunday school and church, all I heard about was burning in hell. I didn't hear about forgiveness. And no matter how bad you've been, what Bob said, it doesn't matter what we've done here. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if all your life you have been so atheist that you have put your fist up to God. It doesn't matter. God loves you. God loves you. You're sober. We're sober. God loves me. How somebody like me gets to be sober. What happens is that on page 62, starting with the first paragraph, here it is. This is what keeps me from God. Selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, doesn't say denial. To deny something is know it's there and just say, I don't, it's not there. Delusion is not to have a clue it's there. I mean, to absolutely not even know I'm as sick as I'm sick as I am. I don't have a clue how far off the beaten path I really am. I don't have a clue. Not a clue. Self-seeking. I'm looking for alcohol and drugs. I'm saying I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And my children are dying in the wake. Absolutely having problems in school, you know, don't bring anybody home anymore, are embarrassed. When I was supposed to attend a function at my youngest son's school, and I was going to go to his school that day, and he looked at me with as much hate as any little boy could have looked at me, and he said, "Don't you dare show up at my school because I am ashamed of you." That's the disease of alcoholism. That's what it is. But I am self-seeking. I'm going to school not because at the moment I'm thinking, you know, trying to help my son. I'm going to school so they'll think I'm a good mother. And my son's like, "Don't show up. Don't show up. Don't do this for you." Because even though I thought I was trying to do things for other people, what I was doing was I was doing things so you would think I'm better than I am. And it's not until I can see that that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem that I can begin to see that somehow I've got to move this stuff out of the way. I've got to make a decision that I am going to surrender myself to God and let Him begin to work with me, that it's going to work. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. See, that's the delusion right there. We don't realize that we're doing the things that we're doing. And somehow in our little heads, we can justify it. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And then the big statement is God makes that possible. God makes that possible. There are some promises before in the third step. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. We're going to get some promises here. You think the promises are just, you know, we just read the promises and after the ninth step, and you think those are the only promises in the big book? We have so many promises. And every step, I did a workshop with Sister B, and she does a workshop on promises. And it's wonderful because she does this workshop, and she goes through each step and gives you all the promises. And it's fabulous. After all the steps have promises. And this one says that I'm going to have a new employer. Well, one of the things that happens is Bob was talking about, you know, we can have worship of other things. And sometimes we think we have something to do with our good fortune. Well, I probably do. If I suit up and show up and go to work, I get to keep my job. And it does require some work from me. I love the story about the farmer standing out, and he's looking at his farm, and the priest walks down the street, and he says to the farmer, "Oh my gosh, look at the farm God gave you." And the farmer says, "Yeah, and you should have seen it when only God had it." So God needs some work from me. I need His help, but I need to begin to take some actions. So I have a new employer. Now, one of the things that happens a lot of times is that God is obscured by worship of other things. And sometimes this new employer, I don't like the income he's giving me. I don't like the house I live in. I like your house better. I like your six-figure salary better than mine. All of these things that keep me from God, those starting to look at those seven deadly sins already, because that new employer, I have a new employer. God is going to tell me what to do. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, as bad a shape as I was in, I was a realtor in Texas. And at times, I probably have made more money when I was drunk than I have ever made sober. And because what happened was, is I was able to sell real estate for whatever reason. And I sold real estate, and one day I was late to a meeting. And Frank looked at me and he says, "You have yourself in this meeting every night at 8 o'clock and you don't be late. And you let God sell that real estate." And he says, "If you put AA first, I promise you that God will take care of you." And I didn't, it took me a long time to get it. But then I remember, after I was sober a while, it was like what Bob was talking about. I worked in alcoholism treatment for 15 years. And I worked in it when I felt like it was based on the principles that I believed in. And when I could no longer believe in that, I left. But what happened was, is I would rather work for less money and be able to serve God in the way I felt I wanted. I felt that need to want to serve God. And what happened was I gave up that job and did something else. And what happened is that new employer started paying me off in dividends way better than I had ever, ever hoped to have. And I get to do that today. I'm retired. There's some really good things about being old. And that is that you get to be retired and the government pays you not to work. And it's wonderful. And what I get to do today is all the stuff I've always wanted to do. I used to say my life began at 6 o'clock because I worked from 7 to 6. Because in order for me to do the stuff I did in AA on the weekends, I needed to work a four-day week. And what I get to do today is I get to do what I've always wanted to do. Now, I live on a fixed income. You know, we don't have any extras. But the good news is that I get to do the things I've always wanted to do. I get to come to Park City, Utah. I don't have to go home till Tuesday so I can go to the Monday night meeting. But if I were working, I wouldn't be able to do those things. And I'm getting paid. My new employer is giving me different dividends. And that's a huge promise. And all I had to do was just make a decision. Just make a decision. I'm going to let this God begin to run my life. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Now, I feel like going back to page 14 and Bill's story. I like to read it because I'm not too good at paraphrasing it. Where it talks about, "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead." So what I feel like is to perform his work well is I have to work with others. And if I don't do this work, how can I work with others? Because it's really clear when it talks about I can't later on in the book that I can't give away that which I do not have. I can't give it away if I haven't done the work myself. So what I have to do is stay close to God, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to him, and believe that he's going to lead me in a way that's going to work, that's going to be good for me. Now, I can remember in 1993, our first grandchild was born. And by the middle of 1994, we found out that Ryan was profoundly deaf. You know, I did not agree with God. I did not think this was a good idea. I didn't think this was good at all. And I really had my fist at God. You know, my life wasn't turned over. I wasn't watching what was going to unfold. And my finite mind, I saw something wrong with that happening. What am I? And I'm angry. I see that what is happening is that people are out there, start making judgments. Look at all these people. It's alcoholics and drug addicts, and they have all these babies, and they don't even want them, like me. I was one of those. Couldn't take care of my kids. They don't even want them. We want our baby so bad, and our baby's born deaf. I couldn't see that. But what I needed to do is I needed to stay close to him. And what we decided to do, all four of us, James and Kelly and Dave and I, we're in AA. And so what we did is we went to the top of page 63. And we looked at this and we said, we're going to have to perform our work well. And we're going to have to stay close to God. What is it that God wants us to do here? Well, what we did is we looked at our little boy. And we wanted to be able to communicate with our little boy. So right then and there, he was only 18 months old. We all head off to college, and we're going to learn to sign. And we're going to pick so we can talk to our little boy. Well, what happens to that is that God uses that. And he gives us what we needed. And what we needed is for whatever reason, I don't get it. It's just like what... I do get it. It's God. It's those God shots. What Bob was talking about, those feelings that say, go to that meeting, do this. For whatever reason, God working in my life, what happens to me? It seems like over and over and over, I get deaf people, deaf women coming my way. Right now at our home group in Bellingham, Washington, once a month we have a speaker meeting. And that speaker meeting, paid for by our group, is signed. We get to perform our work well. But I have to stay close to him and see that I'm going to get what I need. It doesn't say I'm going to get what I want. I'm going to get a new BMW. I have a 13-year-old Honda. But it's all I need. It is absolutely all I need. That I will perform his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. The more I become less interested in myself and my wants, the closer I began to feel God and to be able to find out what it is I need to do to perform his work well. Our little plans and designs, and these are all promises, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. That's a fabulous promise, because the less I'm interested in myself, the quieter the head. Our little plans and designs, more and more, and our little plans and designs, period. All of a sudden, you know, I'm not sitting around thinking, how many jobs would it take, and what will I have to do in order to buy a BMW? So I'm not working this all around in my head. That takes a lot of energy. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. And here it says, which is huge, the biggest promise of all, and it's right before we take the third step. It says, we were reborn. I had a gal come up to me earlier, and she says, my birthday is April the 11th, 1977. She says, we're both 31. Because I've been reborn. I'm not the person who came in here 31 years ago. And in the first 3 years of my sobriety, I was not a person who was really an attraction to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't, just because of some of the things that I did behind relationships and sex. I was still trying to feel good through you. I just knew if you love me enough and care for me enough and do all these things for me, that I'd feel better. See, I didn't know I was going to have to heal from the inside out, that I was going to have to reach out and love you. We drive psychiatrists and psychologists crazy because they don't get us. See, what happens is their thing is, do it for yourself. Do it for yourself. Man, I was trying to make myself feel so good, I landed up in here. That's what happened to me by trying to make myself feel good. It wasn't until I was willing to see what I could do for you that I began to feel better. And I began to come out of myself. So really what we're doing here is kind of twofold. What we're doing is we're helping others and we're doing the work in the book. And we're doing this together. It's all at the same time. So what happens is, one of the things, I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was about 4 months sober. And this gal asked me to sponsor her. And I went up to Frank and I said, well, I can't sponsor her. You know, I don't know anything. I'm only 4 months sober. And he says, just stay a step ahead. That's all. Just stay a step ahead. So if you're sitting here waiting and waiting and waiting to sponsor, go get a sponsee. If you've taken step one, go get a sponsee. And quick, do two before they catch up with you. That's, you know, just get out there and do it. Because it's going to be those two things working hand in hand, me helping others and me working and doing the work in the book and keeping myself sane and sober. But I work the book and I help others. I need them together. Because I can tell you, I know people who know this book page and paragraph, word for word, and they can't stay sober. I also know people who go out and they hang out in AA and they're on every committee, they're doing every service job, they're doing all this stuff, and they can't stay sober. So what it says to me is that I need it all. I need the steps. I need to be working the steps. I need to be in the fellowship. I need to be going out to coffee. I need to be showing up at a meeting. I need to be making AA attractive. And I need to be into service. I need to be doing it all. Doing one of any of them is not going to work. I can memorize this book line for line. And if I'm not out doing something and practicing this and taking it outside and getting out of myself, if I'm in here learning this book and I'm not working with others, I'm not getting out of myself. I'm not self-sacrificing for others. It doesn't say, you know, it doesn't say, well, when the phone rings, answer it if you feel like it. That's not self-sacrifice. Bob.
Okay, so ten minutes.
Ten minutes.
Then we'll have to go a little shorter.